His name is John R., and he comes from Norfolk, and his home group is Many a Strange Camel, and he's been so gracious to come out here, speak for us, and also supply us with three more speakers for the rest of the month, and I do believe they're here as well. Well, two are here. So please give a round of applause. Hi, everybody. My name is John Rotta, and I'm an alcoholic. I normally don't bring notes, but I'm trying something out. I think of it this way. I like to keep a little bit of a roadmap, because otherwise I might just forget to tell you my housekeeping. So let's get that out of the way first. My housekeeping, my sobriety date is September 3rd, 2021. My home group, like Jake said, is Many Strange Camel. We meet at Larchmont United Methodist Church, 7 p.m. on Tuesdays. I also have a service obligation there. I'm their treasurer, and I have had the pleasure of sponsoring other young men. So I was told recently a little nugget to not spend so much time in my drug log and to get into the practical application of my daily life, because I noticed this in some of my work when I like to, one of my favorite things that my home group does is we like to take meetings into places. We go to places like Avenues, the Naval Hospital, Safe Harbor, and we talk to newly sober folks in treatment. One night I had spouted off all the terrible things that I'd been through, and he said, "Man, that might be the worst night of your life or the worst things you've ever been through, but that sounds like a Tuesday to me." And I said, "Well, I hate to tell you, but I used to be you." In fact, in treatment, I did that exact same thing. I found myself comparing myself away from every terrible story that I heard a speaker ever tell me. Said, "I'm not like him, I'm not that bad." Or even worse, "I'm not like him because I'm worse off than he is." I'm going to get into some of that in just a second. The advice that I gave him was, don't try to find yourself different from what I have to say, but find the similarities in the people in the rooms with you. That's where you're going to find the reasons and the solutions to the problem that we all share. So I'll start off a little bit about what it was like. Come from a happy family. Mom and Dad are happily married to this day. I like to think that's because Dad spends part of his time, half of his week up here in Norfolk, and then he goes back home to North Carolina on the weekends. I'll get back to that in a second as well. That paid off for me when I got out of rehab because that was a free ride home to see Mom. They are happily married. I have an older sister. She used to be my best friend. We're working on that today. But I have no excuse to be an alcoholic. I was never abused. I was never beaten. My parents are take it or leave it. I hate it. My sister, she's one of those, she has a problem that we would pray for. Two shots of tequila and she gets a headache so bad that she doesn't want anymore. But one thing that did happen, I was an awkward kid. I never felt like I was part of the group. I always felt less than or part, you know, part away, whatever we want to call it. I was a loner. I learned very early on to be independent because I couldn't rely on anybody because I didn't want to tell you what was going on inside me. I didn't have friends close enough that I felt comfortable to say, "Hey, man, I'm having a bad day." I didn't know how to articulate depression or anxiety or anything else. So I masked it all with humor. I liked to find out what jokes you thought were funny, and I'd memorize those and I'd repeat them all the time. So poser was used a couple of times. I remember trying to fake skateboarding for a little while. That didn't last very long. So all those things were me trying to latch on to what was normal when inside I felt anything but. It was about 15 years old. My older sister was 18, and I wanted to be cool. They thought I was cool. I was in eighth grade at the time, and I got the opportunity to play on the drum line for the high school. So I was already hanging out with a lot of the older kids, and we got a hold of some booze and a field party and a beer bong. So I beer bonged, I think it was 7 Hornsby's in a row. And at 15, I think I weighed maybe 90 pounds. I got alcohol poisoning that night. Leslie, my older sister, she snuck me into the house as quiet as she could, but I puked through 2 sleeping bags. I woke up the entire house. Mom and Dad, of course, threw me in the shower, fed me coffee and bread, which only made me awake, pissed off, and wet. So I wasn't a happy camper, and I was drunk. So next morning I wake up, and it was about 7 a.m. in the summer in Winston-Salem, about as humid as it is out here, and 90-some degrees, and Dad thought it would be funny to make me mow the grass. So I'm mowing the grass in the middle of the summer, sweating everything from the night before out. Because it was the six beers and then God knows what, or six or seven beers, and then God knows whatever else I got a hold of. I'm sweating all that mess out. And after I get done, I'm sitting on the porch swing, and Dad walks up, and he's got two beers in his hands. He hands one to me, and he drinks one. And that was like, okay, so I just did, you know, something pretty crappy, right? I'm grounded, right? Well, of course you're grounded. Okay, why are we having a, like, what is this? So I was very confused by this idea of what was going on. But I did know one thing. That night, even as bad as it was, I woke up that morning feeling like death, and I couldn't wait to do it again. I could not wait to get drunk again. Put whatever substance it could be to make me feel different, because something I noticed that night, I was all of a sudden funny. I was hitting on girls. I was popular. Those dudes, they thought it was hilarious to make the 15-year-old chug a beer. So all those feelings of less than and a part of and all that crap, it had all gone away because I had this new superpower of I can drink like the grown-ups. So I couldn't wait to do it again. And every thought after that became about finding a substance that would make me feel different than the way I felt when I looked in the mirror, when I was forced to actually sit in my own emotions. So about 3 years later, I got accepted early to Appalachian State. I wanted to be a music major. I wanted to be a rock star. I had all these big dreams, but I couldn't make it to class at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I for sure couldn't pass an exam. So I started switching majors because I was going to parties too much. I was doing everything but class, chasing booze and girls. I ended up dropping out of Appalachian State. And I'm going to kind of hit fast forward here for a second, because once we start collecting DUIs, we all know how to get drunk and we know what it looks like. Long story short, I was at Appalachian State from 2001 to 2006, and I didn't get an associate's degree. When they finally wanted to kick me out, I said, "You can't kick me out. I'm going to leave." And I stayed in Boone, and I started working in restaurants. And I would have that. I had that career for the next 20 years, bouncing around North Carolina. Got my first DUI in 2004, a second one in 2008. I want to talk real quick about what it looked like the one time I did want to quit. Because of those two DUIs, I did have to do some weekends in jail. So the only time that I was ever without my substances, which I can't even say I was without because I snuck Vicodin into the place, I was doing weekends in the Forsyth County jail. And I was doing 23-hour lockdown. And what that looks like is 23 hours with a stranger, and you better hope to God you get along because you're not allowed out but for 15 minutes, 45 minutes a day. Anyhow, that was the first time I'd ever gone without booze since I was about 18 years old, was during those weekends. I started to feel the jitters, starting feeling weird. And in fact, my girlfriend at the time, she would pick me up every Sunday afternoon with two tall boys ready to go because that was how much it was going to take for to get me from Forsyth County Jail to our apartment on Peacehaven Road. Now, if you know anything about Winston-Salem, that's not that far. So anyway, my uncle passed away in just a couple years after that, and I can't remember if it was 2008 or 2009. But either way, he was one of us. He got sober before he passed. He even quit smoking. I mean, it was a miracle. I look at it because I'm like, I still haven't quit smoking. Here we are 4 years later almost. But so he died sober, and I said that day, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to have to go to WiccaCon or AA or any of those silly meetings you people talk about, so I'm going to get sober. And I quit drinking one day, and on the third day, it was his funeral, and I had a seizure on the way to his gravesite at his funeral. I woke up. I was in the hospital surrounded by my aunt, my uncle, my mom, and my dad. All the people that very well should have been burying my uncle that day, they were there in the hospital with me. When the doctor said something funny, and he said, if you quit drinking, you're going to die. What he really said in reality was, this is directly related to your alcoholism. Doctors usually don't say alcoholism, but this was at Hosky, North Carolina, so they usually, you know, they'll throw stuff at you. They'll throw anecdotes at you. He might as well have said, boy, you're a drunk, because that would have had more effect. Because I heard, if I quit drinking, then I die. Because I went on for the next, 10 years or so, continued to drink every day, if not harder than I did before. What would have been 12-pack, it turned into 30. April of 2021, I'm going to go ahead and skip there. April 2021, I got the first DUI that summer. It was the beginning of a downward spiral. April 11th, got pulled over for that. Let's stick with the 11th for a second because that'll be funny in a minute. That next month on my birthday, May 19th, I walked into my current job and I said, if you don't hire me more help, I'm going to quit. Well, they fired me. So I had a DUI on the docket. I just lost my job. I went and got another job at a place called the Landing at Mackey's. That's if y'all know where Edenton is. It's on the backwater across the Albemarle Sound. So I'm working there and pretty much working for my bar tab because Sundays I get off of work and spend $80 that day and then buying more and, you know, hanging out with the folks in the marina. If you've never met people that live in a marina, it's not the yacht club. This is like transient restaurant work. My kind of, I mean, I absolutely loved it. In fact, I'm going to get back to them in a minute too. So I was clearly on a downward spiral. August 11th. So I capped off the summer, if you're just doing the math here. April 11th, beginning of the summer. August 11th, towards the end of the summer. I'd gotten into an argument with my girlfriend that afternoon at 4:30 in the morning. And did y'all do the math? She ended up getting mad and she drove. I was house sitting for my mom. She drove from our house, or from mom's house to our house, which was right across Highway 32, which is a two-lane on our side of the water. You couldn't finish a cigarette from one place to the other. But she managed to run the one stop sign in between and T-boned another vehicle, totaled two cars, put the other driver in the hospital. She calls me crying. I just got in a car accident and it's your fault somehow. My codependent ass got in the car because I was going to talk the cops out of arresting her. He arrested both of us. And about 4 hours later, her stepmom got us out of jail, and I was doing the alcoholic math that we only had a six-pack in the fridge. Her car was totaled. Mine was the only one we had that was usable. It's on the side of the highway, so I said, hey, stop the car. And I got into mine and started to drive it back to our house. It wasn't 100 yards later that the blue lights flashed, and the same cop that arrested us at 5:30 in the morning was then arresting me for the second time in less than 12 hours. I love telling that story in rooms because y'all get a good kick out of it. Now, in the time of all that going on, my delusion smashed somehow. Because the first one, I knew I was an alcoholic. I mean, I knew I was an alcoholic long before that. I knew I was an alcoholic when the doctor told me I was an alcoholic. And if I stopped drinking, then I was going to die. But I never tried to quit from that point because I remembered what it felt like when I tried to quit because of the jail time. And I knew that was miserable. And then, obviously, if I completely went cold turkey without any substances in my body, I would have a seizure and die. And I didn't really have the balls to kill myself. So I was at an impasse. And sorry for using graphic language, we are in the church. I need to remember this. I was at a place in my life where I couldn't live with it, and I knew I couldn't live without it. And I needed to do something because one way or another, the state of North Carolina was going to put me somewhere that doesn't serve alcohol. So I decided to get ahead of it, and I was going to go to rehab. I checked in voluntarily to a place called Fellowship Hall in Greensboro, North Carolina, and I stayed there for 3 months. I didn't care to get sober. I didn't want to go to AA. I knew what AA was. I had family in the rooms. They were all condescending, judgmental, talking crap about each other. And my aunt married her sponsor, and that looked weird. I knew it wasn't right, but I didn't know exactly why. But y'all call it 13th stepping, and I even called them out on it. I was like, if that's what y'all are doing, I'm not interested. You can go to hell with it. So I avoided the rooms. But then when I was in rehab, they had us focus on the first five steps, which in 3 months, for 28 days, you're lucky if you got past the first three. I was an overachiever by the time I thought I would look cool in rehab. Because remember, I wanted to look good for court. I was looking for that piece of paper at the end of it, and I wanted to say, John Rada is a grade A rehab student. Like, I was going to run that up to the judge, like, don't put me in jail, look at what I did. So I was doing everything I could to get through all five steps that they put in front of me. And they had these speakers, just like we're doing right now, come into the rehab every night, where we had meetings just like this every night. And I compared myself to those people. I said, I'm not as bad as him. I never got married, so I never cheated on my wife. I don't have kids to beat, so I never beat them. And then one guy was talking about his DUIs and all the things that he had done, and I was like, holy crap, I beat his record. And that was when I started to notice, hold on, there might be something here. After 28 days, because this was all in the thick of COVID, they took us out to regular meetings out in Greensboro, and I started to meet y'all. Not other people at rehab, not alumni that were coming back to feel good about themselves, but you guys. That's when I started really seeing the difference. I started seeing what was right, what was the similarities between us. And in those first three steps, I didn't know it at the time, but I would find everything I was looking for in the first three steps without substances. That feeling that I'd always felt a part of, because I knew by 28 days, I figured out I could live without alcohol. I could live without substances. I mean, by day 8, the delirium's out of your system, so you're on your own. And I just wanted to find out how to be happy. How could I be content in the sober life that I was building? Because remember, I don't want to be sober. I wanted to get out of there and get back to drinking. I was going to get, you know, this was basically going to dry me out. I was going to go from 30 beers a day to like a six pack maybe. You know, that's how normal people drink. But by the end of the 3 months, something fun happened. I talked to my cousin one night, and Cousin Dewey. These guys know Cousin Dewey. We were close when we were kids, and substances separated us. And then in sobriety, we've become even closer than ever. But I called him up one day, and I said, man, I just don't get it. They're talking about God. They're talking about this and that. And it sounds stupid. You know, God is not something I ever got along with. And he said, man, it's not about a God. It's not about the religious God. It's just something that you believe in. Do you believe in God? And I said, well, sure, man. He goes, well, don't you ever pray? And I said, well, hell yeah, every time I'm in trouble. And he said, well, can't you wrap your head around something that you can do business with, like something that's not you? And of course, I'm ad-libbing for Dewey because he doesn't sound this articulate. He's from Ahoskie. These two know about this. But basically, he told me something that it changed my life, and it was a simple little prayer, and I've carried it with me every single day. It's, God, I can't. You can. Please help me. That simple little prayer. I'm not one to get on my knees. I'm not one to make a big show out of prayer, talk about God a whole lot, but that's something that I can start and end my day with. I can stop my day, change my mood with that. I can get through an obstacle, challenge, whatever it be, traffic, 264, God bless. And how I wanted to get that back to us. So how does that feed us from rehab to Norfolk? Well, let's get there real fast. So after treatment, there was a fight with a counselor. I have to tell you all about that because otherwise the next part won't make sense. I had this one counselor in particular. She wanted to talk about triggers and emotions and all that kind of stuff. One weekend, I wanted to get home to bury my dog. She had passed away before I went to rehab. And she said it was too much of an emotional trigger that I'd probably get home and use. She doesn't understand that the nearest gas station was 15 minutes away from Mom's house, and Mom's neighbors were all my kin, including the last lady that ever bailed me out of jail. Mom, Bert, was our next-door neighbor. So there was no way I was getting booze when I went home. And I tried to explain that to her, but it came out with a whole lot of cuss words, and I was screaming and yelling, and she was just basically smirking. I said, who in the hell do you think you are to tell me about my addiction? And then she told me that when she was 36, she got sober and went to a community college. After community college, she went to Greensboro State. I believe that's the Aggies, whichever one that is. And she got her undergrad in human services, and then she went back for her master's in social work. Then she got licensed with an LCSW, and she became a counselor at a rehab. I said, well, I'm pretty sure I could do your job. And she did exactly that. She said, I think you could, and she put me on her path. She helped me get into Tidewater, because at the time I was up in the air about where I was going to go. Now, I had the option of staying in Greensboro or moving back to Edenton, because my plan was I was going to move back to Edenton and live in that marina, and I was going to buy the storefront of the restaurant that I was working in, basically renting the property from the people that owned it. And I was going to live on a boat in the marina, and I was going to stay sober. Before I had left, I had told Job about this great idea. I said, man, fix up one of them boats for me. I'm going to be there in about 3 months, or 1 month, because remember, I wasn't going to stay there for three. Well, when I got back, by that time, I had a different plan. And I go back to Mackey's every now and then. I eat there whenever I go back home to meet up with Mom and Dad. And I see Job, and I see Lydia, and they're awful proud. But they didn't fix up a boat for me. So my first resentment was actually, I was pretty mad that they didn't do that, even though I wasn't planning on moving there anyway. Because the deal with Norfolk, there was a community college right here that my counselor helped me get into. And started at Tidewater. My dad had an apartment up here because he was working part-time for and he still works for the city. He's your tax assessor. So he had an apartment up here, and he goes home every Thursday. That was a free ride because I didn't have a license because North Carolina took that forever. I started getting down with meetings because there was also a great, other than that, steps 1, 2, and 3 prayer, the best practical application of the principles that I could think of was somebody once told me, take the same energy that you had towards chasing booze, chasing drugs, and use that for something good, whether that be service work, your education, your career, whatever it may be, just point it in the right direction. Clinically, we call that cognitive restructuring. Out here, for normal people, we just call that motivation. So I ended up coming up here, got into school. Tidewater's great because they have a 4-point scale. I'm going to sell them real quick because one of my buddies over here is thinking about going to school. One of the greatest things about Tidewater is they have a 10-point scale. If you have a 91, that's called an A. At normal schools, that could be an A minus. But needless to say, an idiot like me could get a 4.0 after with an associate's degree over at Tidewater, which I did. And then with a letter of recommendation from that counselor back at Fellowship Hall, she helped me get into ODU, where I graduated this past May with a degree in human services. Needless to say, the path is to go to grad school to get that, and now it's going to be in counseling instead of social work. But all that happened because I was able to motivate myself or cognitively restructure my bad habits into something good. And I had that steps 1-2-3 prayer. And I know I'm skipping back because here's back to the important stuff. When I got done with rehab, it wasn't just all school. Let's rewind all the way back. That last night I got arrested. Obviously, stepmom couldn't bail me out of jail twice because she had just gotten in trouble. Y'all know there's such thing as aiding and abetting, a DUI. So she got charged at the same time as I did. So the whole family now has charges. The ex-girlfriend, the ex-future stepmom-in-law, and I all have court dates in Plymouth. So the last person that I had to call to bail me out of jail was actually my Aunt Bert, who lived right next door to my mom. Mom and Dad, remember I was house-sitting, they were down at Myrtle Beach. So Bert had to bail me out of jail. And here's something else that stuck with me through the years. The drive from Plymouth to Mom's house is usually about 20 minutes, 30 if you get stuck behind a tractor. But that day it was like an hour and a half, and she was giving me what I like to call the come to Jesus talk. It was all up and down about me. And it wasn't pretty. She wasn't cussing. In fact, she didn't raise her voice. But she did say one thing as we parked the car at the gas station so I could pick up a 12-pack so I didn't have a seizure on her watch. She said, "I'm tired of watching your mom pray for it to be done." Didn't say pray for it to be over, pray for you to get better, pray for you to somehow. She just said done. And I looked at her funny. She goes, "Yeah, that's right. She doesn't want it. She doesn't want. I'm tired of watching your mom pray every night, not to get a phone call that you're wrapped around a tree somewhere, not that you got arrested somewhere, just that it's done." And that, the difference there was that I had dug my relationship with my family so far in the crap, I'm trying not to cuss, that my cool aunt, probably one of the coolest people I've ever met in my life, she just didn't want to see mom worry anymore. And then I thought about what that must have looked like to my mom. And with that was half the reason why I went to rehab in the first place. Now, the thing about Bert, while I was in rehab, she was diagnosed with uterine cancer. And at first, it seemed like it was something treatable. She told the doctor to get out the big guns because she was going to fight it with everything she had. By October, it had metastasized. And then by Christmas, when we were really bad into COVID, she had 13 lesions in her brain, multiple tumors around her chest. It was in her into the breastbone, rib cage. Needless to say, April of 22, she passed away. I was, September to April. Somebody do the math for me. I was about 30 minutes sober. And it was the first time that I had to face emotions like that. Because remember, I didn't have anything from my childhood that would have said, hey, this kid's going to be an alcoholic. He's got trauma. He was abused. I didn't have any of that. I had my grandmother that passed away at a natural age. But this is the first time that somebody had been, literally, it felt like she was taken from me. I remember having resentments, all sorts of different anger issues. If there was a God, I didn't want to talk to him anymore. And that was right after I'd found this 1-2-3 prayer that had the solution to all my problems, and I just didn't want any of it anymore. And I wanted to go find somewhere to hide. And I remember slamming a door, running back into my mom's house, and I didn't want to talk to my family about it. I didn't want to be around anybody, and I just wanted a drink. And I turned around, I went back to my family, and I said, nope, I did that last time. And I hid for 2 years, and it was for something not even nearly as bad as this. And we sat down and ugly cried and yelled, and we hated God together. We hated all the things together, and we came out the other side whole. And I like to tell everybody, don't be worried. I still say that step 1-2-3 prayer, and I do believe in my higher power more today than I did then. If anything, it just proved to me that sometimes life is going to piss you off. You just have to find the solution in the moment to get through it without that drink. Because our solution sometimes, there's one of my favorite alcoholics. He likes to say, the ugly ones count. And that was probably the ugliest day in my sobriety up to that point. And for somebody brand new, you know, not even a year sober yet, that was the first challenge. And came through the other side. I was closer with my family than ever. I made a promise to my folks at rehab that, you know, we had one of those mediated conversations where a counselor had to sit with us. You know, somebody with more credentials than me had to make sure that we didn't kill each other. We started talking about honesty and no more hiding, no more lies. And I made a promise to them that there are no more lies about anything. And to this day, I keep that promise. Everything that goes through this head, even the funny stuff, especially the funny stuff, I like to share it with Mom. I probably call her at least once a day now. Because I'm rebuilding those relationships day by day. I mean, here we are. It's not even 4 years yet. I've turned two parents, a mom that used to change the subject if my name came up, a dad that never wanted to talk to me, a sister who, shoot, I was never around for the kids. So that was her biggest resentment. In fact, I remember one time, I'm skipping again. Sorry, y'all are getting a crash course in my ADHD brain tonight. I have to tell you to fill in the story about Aunt Bert. So within 1 year of Aunt Bert passing away, my uncle had remarried one of his nursing assistants. And so my mom had this huge resentment. That's all she talked about, right? And in fact, me and my sister, that's all we talked about was Mom talking about this thing going on with the neighbor, right? So anyway, I said to my sister one time, I said, man, it's annoying that Mom keeps talking about Uncle Dover. And my sister said, yeah, she had just stopped talking about you. So that wraps us into the amends part of this. So the amends with Mom, obviously I sat down with her during that mediated conversation. I said, what can I do to make our relationship better? I've messed this up royally. She said, I want you to go back to school. Y'all already know about school, what happened there. I said the same thing to my father. And that he was the one that was all about the lie. No more lies, honesty. I want to know everything that's going on. He didn't know what addiction was. He was like, while you're going through this, I want to know what it is. We thought it was a willpower problem before I went to rehab. We were introduced to the idea that this thing was a disease. So that was his part. I sit down with my sister and I said the same thing. And I was expecting her to, you know, whatever, bygones are bygones. She said, no, no, no. You have a niece and a nephew that you've spent no more than three beers at a time with for the last decade. Because that's what I'd do. I'd come over to your house, I'd have three beers, and I'd go to the next house, have three beers, and then go to the next. So that means Christmas, I would come over, let them open up some presents while I finished three beers, and I'd go on to the next place so I could drink like I wanted to. And that was their entire lives. Because at the time when I got sober, I think Jack was 13 and Avery was 10. I might be off by 1 year there, plus or minus. But so for the past 3.5 years, I've been there in the summertime. I'm pulling them on jet skis. I'm going to dance recitals. Last weekend I was at Busch Gardens because Avery's sixth grade band had to be up there. My sister was tapped to be a chaperone and she couldn't stand the band parents, so she asked me to go with her. I was like, no, right on. I'm cooler than the band parents, right? But the best part of that amends is that I was there for all those moments and so was my sister. And she got to watch me develop into what you people suggested I do. So that was cool. She's very close with me as well. That relationship isn't where it was, but at least it's getting there. And my niece and nephew still think I'm one of the coolest people on earth. I get to have conversations with them today that when they ask questions like, Uncle John, why do people drink? I don't tell them, man, it's bad for you, never do that. I tell them, well, I'm gonna be honest with you. And I tell them the truth. Why do people smoke marijuana? Why do people do drugs? Why do people take any substances? And they're at that age where they're curious about a lot of things. And if without somebody with the facts tells them something, they'll fill in the blank themselves, because that's what we do. A lot of people in this room, we filled in the blanks by ourselves because we didn't have anybody, we call it properly armed with the facts about themselves. But truthfully, with some kind of factual information to back it up, we had the DARE program. How many of y'all graduated DARE? Right on. Did y'all write the essay? But so anyhow, I get to have that relationship with my niece and nephew today, all because of things like steps 1, 2, and 3. Now I want to talk more about today and what that looks like. I want to close this thing out. Oh, cool. Doing really good on time, actually. What my life looks like today. I told you about school. Oh, I can tell you about the DUIs. Because I don't know, there were a couple of guys here when we drove up. You noticed I drove. A year after I was convicted, well, let's go back to the conviction. So from that September when I got in trouble until the following September 17th of 22, we had continuation after continuation, and I had to see my ex and my ex-future stepmother at every court date. Of course, they hated the sight of me, because not to gloat or anything, but I was looking good. She was still drinking, and so was her stepmom. And I got to see what the progression of what, hey, if I'd have stuck around, maybe if I hadn't decided that day that I was going to go to rehab and maybe, you know, trust in her lawyer, whatever, that her dad was going to hire for me. I don't know. Maybe I would have just gotten a slap on the wrist like she did, or maybe I would have gone to jail for a couple of years. I don't like to play that game. But on September 17th of 2022, I told the truth about myself to a judge, and he didn't put me in jail. He, in fact, loved the fact that I had gotten into school. I was doing well in school. I'd gotten involved with you guys. He was more impressed by that. He wanted to know about what kind of meetings are you going to? Do you have a home group? He was talking a language I recognized a little bit too much. Not only did he not put me in jail, but he put me on unsupervised probation, which meant I could move back up here to Norfolk. Now, I pushed my luck a little bit, and I said, what about that license? And he goes, no, you're never getting that back. Well, a year from then, I called North Carolina, and I said, all right, it's been a year, just for grins and giggles. Y'all know I'm trying hard. These guys know over here that I'm trying hard not to curse. But so I called up North Carolina and I said, what do I need to do? What kind of hoops do I got to jump through to get my license back? And they said, well, it looks like, Mr. Rutter, all you got to do is pay this fine and that fine and this blah, 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 which is all money problems, which my sponsor will say any money problem isn't much of a problem at all, which he's rich, I'm not. But still, it was just a couple of fines. So really, in the grand scheme of things, I was like, all right, so I'll scratch some money together. I'll pay off the DMV. And they said, I can get my license back here in Virginia. And I said, what about a blow box? They said, well, that's up to Virginia DMV. So I made a little appointment over at the DMV office. I get in there, and I show them that I paid off the fines. And they issued me a license. And I said, what about a blow box? And they said, you don't have a Virginia DUI, so we're not going to make you have a Virginia blow box. I said, I'm not going to ask that question twice. So I drove out of that place without a blow box in my car and a full license, nothing provisional about it. One of the first things I did when I got a big boy job was bought that car out there. I know it's shiny and all that stuff, and it's probably dumb of me to do, but you know what? I kind of worked a little hard the last 3 years, so I decided to treat myself, as my sponsor would say it. But that's all great and fine. I told y'all I graduated. I told you my relationships with my family is getting a hell of a lot better. Let's talk about reality, like real reality. All of that is perfect, but there was a point not so long ago, I think it was like 3 weeks ago, I was at work. By the way, I had turned an internship into a job. But the job they were offering me wasn't exactly what I thought I deserved, and it wasn't exactly the pay rate that I thought I deserved, and it wasn't on the career path that I thought I deserved. You know, at the time, I hadn't even graduated yet. I think this was like April 13th when they officially gave me the job. But I remember I went to my boys over here, and I bitched about it, and I bitched to my sponsor about it, and I bitched to his sponsor about it. And then I called my mom about it. I talked to my dad about it. But the best thing that I did in that moment when they offered me the job is I said, give me 24 hours to think about it. That gave me 24 hours to go and bitch to my counsel all about it, every single one of them. And it wasn't until I got to Frank, my sponsor, the second time, that he started just laughing at me. And I was like, oh, I get it now. Because it's not wrapped up perfectly in the little bow that I think I deserve, that it's not everything that I think I deserve, you know, it's one of those, I didn't hand them a script and I'm mad at them for not following it moments, that I realized I'm an alcoholic and I'm about to burn my life down and it has nothing to do with a drink or a substance. So I said, Frank, I think I need to write some stuff down and think about that for a moment, maybe pray a little bit. I'm going to get back to you. And he just kept chuckling because if it's, I've noticed with Frank, he likes to allow me to say things twice slower so that I know how much of an idiot I'm being. Because he's like, if I give him time, he'll figure it out on his own, right? If he doesn't get it by the third time, that's when he steps in. But so that's the most recent of what my life looks like when I try to take my will back. And that's when I like to hit a meeting. I did forget to tell you guys that internship is actually with a Medicaid outpatient rehab facility. and our population is 99% homeless or in transition of housing. Sobriety is usually secondary to their hierarchy of needs, like eating and where am I sleeping. I haven't seen a doctor in 3 years. My foot might be rotting off because I'm diabetic. That type of population. Now, these folks, God willing, they all understand that sobriety, you know, we like to talk about AA is the last house on the left. No, come to work with me. We are literally the last house on the left. This is where oftentimes, if it doesn't work, relapse is often fatal. The reality of fentanyl is glaring in my face every single day, because I'll have, you know, I have clients that they sometimes get into the program, and because of the way housing and fentanyl and the truth of addiction, they might have one problem and 2 weeks later they've got three. Now, luckily, every now and then, just like any other rehab, you know, one or two out of 100, a light comes on and I get to see that firsthand. Oh, you know, and since January, I've seen it happen three times. And that's three more than I expected. Now, when I want to loop that back to how steps one, two, three, that prayer of mine that gets me out of everything, how that applies. I usually do my speaking engagements to a bunch of newcomers, so thanks for any of y'all with, you know, more than 30 years that are like, you're just entertaining me right now. But so the one, two, three, maybe this will help you guys out as well. But I know that when I'm taking my will back, that's when I'm taking over the conversation. I'm telling God, I think I got this. I deserve this better. I know this plan. I know what's in store for me, and I think I know how to write it. And usually it comes with, some folks call it karma. The speaker next week, he's got crystals he'll rub together about it. But I know that what I'm doing, if it feels a little bit too easy, or if it feels a little bit like a scheme, I know that's what my will looks like. If it looks like I'm trying to get one over on somebody, if I'm getting back to manipulating or lying, that's me. Because left to my own devices, that's what my addiction will take me. And that has nothing to do with a substance. It has nothing to do with a drink. It has everything to do with getting what I think I can get away with. So that makes it real easy for me to identify God's path or God's plan, God's will. Because usually there's some honest effort. Dang it. You know, something that'll make me feel good at the end of the day. You know, it makes me feel just a little bit gross because I'm actually doing a favor for somebody else without something in, you know, return, something transactional. Now, I say that with a smirk on my face because when I first came to these rooms, I didn't want to do anything for y'all. I mean, I told you I didn't want to come to the meeting, so I certainly didn't want to answer a phone call. I didn't want to sponsor anybody. I didn't want to do your steps. I didn't want to do any of these things. But my first sponsor, he very blatantly beat these things into me, saying, you know, not literally, figuratively, especially steps three and four, but made me understand that I will be of no use to anybody else until I make an honest effort of being a better person to the people in society sharing it with me. So that was all found through the steps. And I'll never forget when I truly got to step three, and I do want to talk about God one last time, and what step three meant to me. Truly turning my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. Part of that felt like a cheat code for the gamers in the room. Because that meant that I no longer had to go through the effort of manipulating every single moment of every single day. I could say, you know what? I don't got it. I don't have to have it. I don't need to know where this day is going to end. As long as I'm sober, that's all that really matters. And you know, you fill in the blanks. You tell me where to go. Show me how. And that's what you're really doing when you say, I can't, you can, please help me. Please help me tells me that, dude, I ain't got the wheel. Show me where I'm going today. Present me with somebody else's problem, because God knows if you don't, I'll spend all day in here thinking about you, thinking about me, thinking about you, thinking about me, and all the problems that come with that, being an alcoholic. Because without a drink, without my solution that today is in the big book, without that solution, I will go crazy. I will take my will back, and I'll look at my boss, and I won't say, give me 24 hours. I won't say, let me think about this. I'll say, this can go to hell and back. I'm going to go that way. You keep your job and shove it. Because I know that that's what it looks like, because that's what I looked like for those 20 years in active addiction. And yeah, if I can leave anybody with any kind of practical application, I say that that's a pretty good night to do. I've got about 10 minutes to kill here. Yeah. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, John.